So welcome to episode 13 of IDCast, the podcast arm to Design Truth. My name is Brad Harper and I am an industrial design recruiter. Today me and Drew, we're joined by two agency owners, Tom Osman from Raymond Osman and Tom Parsons over at Ether Product Design, as we tackle the topic of setting up a design agency and some of the realities that come with it. If you want to get involved in a future episode, our live webinars, Design Truth Live, or our university talks, then fire us an email to hello@designtruth.co.uk. Thanks for listening. It's been a while since we've recorded something, Drew. So
yeah.
My intros are normally pretty, they're pretty poor. And also the closing of it is always quite loose as well. But I always say to anyone that I've probably already given you some sort of fancy intro in the pre-edit or the post-edit, or I should say. But if you two guys could just, if we start off with you, Tom O, and then we go on to Tom P in alphabetical order. If you could just give a brief rundown of who you are and who you work for, just so anyone that doesn't know who you guys are can have the brief 30-second synopsis or pitch, so we know who you are.
Sure. I'm Tom Osman. I run Raymond Osman Product Design. So we're based in right in the centre of the country in Warwickshire. So we're near Coventry and Leamington Spa. And yeah, we're taking products all the way from the initial concept all the way through kind of the engineering and the detail design into kind of all the test and development with some quite serious test equipment. And then, into launch.
Good stuff. And how long has it been? How long have you been Raymond Osman?
We're coming up for 6 years now. So,
wow. No way. Amazing.
6 years. And there's a few of you now, isn't there?
Yeah, there's three of us here.
Great. Brilliant. And on to Tom P. So, you guys are a little bit newer than 6 years, aren't you?
Yeah, half that.
Yeah,
just under 3 years now. I'm Tom Parsons. I started Ether Design, about 3 years ago. And we are product design consultancy, so similar to other Tom. We take products all the way from concept to design for manufacture, basically. Yeah. And we're based in Poole, down on the south coast.
Yeah, so if anyone ever gets the chance to follow Tom on Instagram, I would definitely recommend
that you Parsons do. Or Osman.
Parsons, yeah. If anyone that
on Instagram.
Anyone that's on a crowded tube when the tubes will be crowded again, I'd definitely recommend you just look at Tom's Instagram on a really bad working
the
day.
Commute down here is pretty special.
Yeah, so he puts us all to shame. Really, I'll be honest, guys, I've had a lot of questions that have come in, and usually how I normally do this is I normally just write down a boatload of questions. We just have a really informal chat, but seeing as we've had quite a few questions that have come in, I feel quite obliged to go through the questions and then we go that way. Otherwise it'd be really rude to say, can I have some questions, and then just not ask the questions that people,
Brad, what about if we do this to start them off?
Go on.
And to kind of, break the ice and all of that. How about we get them to ask each other a question?
Oh, yeah, go on. Ask a question to each other. who's your best client? No, don't worry. We're going to do. Yeah, well, I think before I run through the kind of the starter question, the real essence of this episode for anyone that's just kind of started up is it's all about setting up an agency. I think my personal opinion, and Drew, I don't know if you're of the similar view, but I think it's going to be a really popular angle for people in the current kind of job climate, whether they're going freelance or whether they're going, I think they're two different things, aren't they?
Yeah.
Working for yourself and then setting up an agency. That's a transition I know Tom O has made in terms of it was just you, wasn't it, Tom? And then it kind of,
The first kind of 6 months was kind of the freelance thing. So it was Martin doing that and kind of trying to work out how to make it into an agency. It was like that little step.
Which always sounds like the sort of the safe and the safe risk mitigated way of doing it. It's like, I know I can just get some contracts in for now.
Yeah.
Once I'm paid out for a little bit, then I can add a junior or something like that. So I'm really keen to hear about that. It might be a totally different experience, but I'm really interested to hear about that.
Yeah. Was there like a moment where it was like, yeah, I think we can bring someone else in now?
I was just swamped. Just working kind of evenings and weekends and early mornings and just couldn't keep up anymore. But by that point, when we set it up, my wife and I always wanted it to be a agency. So it was always a stopgap. Mm. But you kind of have to learn how to run a business. So you go from working in a business and then suddenly you're out by yourself. And although you can be good at what you do, you've got all the other things around it. You've got all the sales, you've got all the marketing, how to set things up and get them running. Like, what's the difference between flat rate VAT and normal VAT, and which one do you want? And all these thousands of questions. Kind of that 6 months just to get that baseline done. And then there was another jump into actually being fully independent.
So call in a few favors to go, sort of anybody in your immediate circle that had done something similar. Maybe you know someone who's a plumber or something like that, and they'd have to face the same kind of, what the hell is this?
The first contracts are all pulling in favors, really. So you've gotten a reputation, and so you're reliant entirely on your network to do it. And so, yeah, through contacts I had at Aston Martin and again at Speedo, they were my first two clients, and that was pretty much it for the first year and a half, until you get that reputation and that experience to actually start expanding out. And it's probably only been the last 3 years that we've had clients that we didn't know before they became clients. So it just takes a while for that to grow and develop.
Yes. Similar journey for you, Tom?
Very similar, actually. Although I didn't necessarily have that freelance bit to start off with. It was very much the game plan from day one was to be an agency or to be a consultancy.
I remember we spoke when you set it up. Yeah.
Funny, actually, I just saw you just messaging me on LinkedIn. I saw the last message was a couple of years ago quite a different situation. I don't know how much I told you then, but the start to Ether was about a year in the planning before leaving Dyson. And originally it was actually meant to be a joint venture. So I actually set it up with an old, it was actually an old boss of mine in product design. And we started the business together. It was kind of my idea concept, and I was kind of joining him, and he'd already been going a couple of years. But it was quite clear early on that he didn't actually want to do the consultancy side, and he was actually more interested in the kind of the camera product side, which is what I used to do with him. Whereas I wanted the variety. I'd come from a kind of in a business working on the same product all the time. I wanted the variety of consultancy. So we broke away pretty early on. And that was really tough, because that was like day one. It was, right, I'm back in the kitchen and no clients and no kind of freelance side to go. I think the kind of easiest transition going into this would have been, I've heard it quite a few times where people have gone freelance for someone that they know, or even the company that they may be working for at the time, and that seems to be a really good transition. I wasn't fortunate enough to have that, so it was very much LinkedIn. And I actually got an email from LinkedIn pretty early on saying I had to pay for premium because I'd used up all my free LinkedIn credits or whatever they are, because I was hustling. that was a really tough kind of 6 months. I guess it was maybe 3 months before I got my first proper client that had a real kind of three or four month project. And then it was about 6 months before our first kind of hire. But again, so similar to what you were saying there, Tom, is actually before I started the business, I was trying to become the best product designer I could be, to become the best consultant I could be. Mm. And then so you start running a business, it's like, ah, I've got to learn so much more about sales. Yeah, as you say, accounts, business, you know, all this stuff that you don't think about that when yeah. you think, I want to.
Did your time in-house best prepare you, though? Because you were on the other side of the coin, weren't you? You were.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, so going to Dyson was actually a step, because really early on, probably 6 or 7 years ago, was the first time I thought, you know, actually consultancy is where I want to end up. And leaving my company before that, I had interviews at consultancies. And my thought process then was, you know, I'm not quite ready. I want to get experience in-house. I want to be working on products that are manufactured in the millions, to get that opposite experience to whereas before I was working on products where we were designing bespoke systems for CPOs. So it was the most biggest production we ever did was, I think, 20 off, you know, it's that kind of thing. So the thought process was to go to Dyson to get that real rounded vision to then go on to start a consultancy. But then in starting the consultancy, then you realize actually sales and how do you get clients and that kind of thing. That's the really hard bit. And then the reason we started expanding originally was because it got to about November in the first year. And I remember there was a whole week where I didn't do any design work. I was in the business, you know, I was doing Skype. So I was going to meetings, I was doing sales calls and all these things. I'm thinking that this isn't why I started the business. I want to be in the design. So at that point, I had Josh, who'd come from, who's another colleague from Dyson, really good friend of mine, came down and started working with me. And we kind of eased him into the business in a way. We started off with kind of a 2-day week, 3-day week. And then I don't know what happened, but the first week he joined, we got two more clients, you know, and it was like, hang on. And then within a month, I think we're doing 6-day weeks. and that's when Sophie came into the business to run the business side. Luckily, she ran her own business as well. So she was running a business for quite a few years before that. So she already knew about the kind of the tax and, that side of it. I didn't worry too much because, she was already a pro at that, but yeah, that first 6 months was tough. I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but it's definitely a learning curve.
Yeah. I think one of the questions I had for you was, how do you get your first client?
Yeah. Just Brad, just quickly.
Go on.
So I had a slightly different experience when
you worked for an agency and then you've got your own side hustle stuff. So
I knew I wanted to emigrate.
Okay.
So I left my full time in house position and set up by myself, and actually took a contracting role at another sort of design engineer agency. So I was working as an industrial designer for, like, really a design engineer. So doing some of the fun stuff, but also having to learn, like, shit, what does all this tax stuff mean? What do I have to do on all that? But it was great because I could ask Kevin about it. It was like you could learn from someone who had had to go through that same process as well, but at the same time really focus on, here's what I need to do, like, in the business, and here's what I need to do on the business. And then as well as that, I also had a couple of other smaller client projects and things as well. Luckily I managed to find my way out of the UK, but it pulled me back so much.
Yeah, for me it was location as well. You talked about kind of emigrating to do a job. For me, it was coming back to the coast. That was really the driver. And then having that opportunity to start that with someone was really the, like, that to me was almost the kind of going freelance risk reducer side. That made it kind of feel a little bit easier. And then because down here, yeah, it is tough as a product designer. There's not a huge amount of work. You kind of, that was my thought process. I need to create a job.
Where I want to be. Because like in Bournemouth, there's the product design course that's been there for years and years and years. Yeah. And yet the only industry that's down there is, well, was magazines and insurance. I don't know what it's like now. There's Sunseekers down there.
We're next door to Sunseeker.
Okay. And then, everyone goes to like Dyson or moves to London or find something else. I don't know anybody who's designing. I mean, like out of my circle, and I went to uni in Bournemouth, I don't know anybody who studied there. And is
pretty similar situation. We're the only consultancy in Bournemouth or Poole. There's a few other product designers on their own and freelancing. But we're the only consultancy. But I don't know why that is, because actually I think what I did learn starting the business and working with clients is that you don't always have to meet them. And that's what's really surprised me, is actually we have clients. I couldn't tell you what they look like. I've never met them. And we've done, so we've got one client at the moment, we're on the second project and never met them face to face. Absolutely. Yeah. We've had lots of Zooms and things like that, but I've had a couple of clients where never even had a phone call. that's the funniest one. We had one client that we did two projects for, and we sent his prototype to a sent his address as well. He lived in a castle. Who is this guy? that's been a real learning curve. For us, we are only an hour and 40 minutes from London at the end of the day. I think if we're in Cornwall, that might be different. But the Bournemouth course, I don't know about your experience, Drew, but I think it is quite a well-renowned course. And being at Dyson, a lot of people in kind of the high up management as well were from Bournemouth, and I do stay quite close to Bournemouth University in terms of, I sit on an advisory board and I mentor a funnier student every year to kind of get in there and actually try and help bring the course forward a little bit. I think product design is a really interesting industry, and Brad, you've spoken about this on LinkedIn quite a lot about the term product design, and it's kind of being stolen.
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
And I really feel bad for people trying to find their first job in product design now, because you look for a product design job and you call them up and they're digital. the kind of landscape of product design has changed, since we were at university. So, and the courses, a lot of courses haven't. So I'm trying to kind of be in that process to help move them on and, build a course that's more towards where we are now.
So for you, Tom, you're more from a kind of a mech eng background, aren't you? Therefore, that kind of classic design of engineer, do you have like a different approach when you're kind of thinking about these first? We did it last time, Drew, when we talk about startups. What are your first 100 days? Because Drew has just started a job and you're kind of heading up not your own startup, but you're heading up the design for a startup.
We'll come back to that. It's not bad.
but just in terms of the fact that those first 100 days you were the only design hire, so a first 100 days for an agency, what is that like? Is it genuinely LinkedIn messaging company? Because I'm just trying to relate it to the job that I do, and there seems because we're an agency, and to a certain degree there is a crossover there in terms of how you would perhaps approach building your kind of, we say, building our desk up, so building our kind of pipeline up. Is it similar in terms of how you guys would go down that route?
Yeah, I think it's the third client that you need to worry about. But the first two is probably someone that you kind of know, or through your network and things like that. That's where LinkedIn, LinkedIn was great, actually. I had some really good kind of links and clients through, I don't know if I actually got a full client, but it was really interesting to learn about how companies use agencies and things like that really early on. But my first client was, first major client was through the other guy, basically, that I set up the business with. And that kind of eased us into, as you say, building a bit of reputation. And we had our kind of just do a good job early days. Don't worry about the money. Just do a good job and people will talk. And under promise, over deliver for as long as you can.
There's a lot of sense in that. Is, you know, the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves, but, you know, represent yourself as well as you can and do the good work. And I think it's very hard to keep hold of that though as well, because obviously those sort of sleepless nights are all about bills arriving and no money coming in.
That's where growing the team and getting, we've just moved offices and it is amazing. It is, you know, it's our second office. I mean, I've gone from kitchen to garage. We're in the garage 9 months, I think. And I go in there now and look around like, whoa, how did we ever do this? And then our first office was incredibly cheap. It was great location, all the rest of it, but it was financially, it was low risk. We should have done it a lot earlier. And then going to our next office. So our office now, it's three times the rent, but it is great, you know, it is really good. And then when you build up the staff as well, there's four of us now on the payroll. So those kind of pressures do increase, but we're trying to keep that same mindset of, you know, it's not about getting deposits in, you know, what's the point in that? It's all about building the business for the future. And actually, if you do just chase those deposits, you're not going to last. I don't know, Tom, if you have the same kind of.
The pennies and the pounds, when you get to it and you've got other people's mortgages on your shoulders, really don't look after themselves. So that actually needs that does need some careful management. But we've got accountants who are great to actually help us with that. And so you're getting rid of all these things that are kind of not your core focus, and someone else is looking after them and giving you that valuable insight and advice to actually make the right calls. But you need to keep a track on it. It's not so much the case when you're freelancing, it's just you, because you can have good months and bad months and all you have to do is make the rent, make your mortgage. But when you've got multiple people, all of which relying on your performance, it needs looking after, and you've got to be focusing on it almost daily. Otherwise stuff goes wrong. And you look at all the big businesses and they all have chief financial officers. And so there is a real need to do that. And it's not the same as designing stuff, unfortunately. Yeah. You've got to really do both at the same time. You can't just do business development solidly for 3 months, because then you've had no cash flow. And you can't just do projects for 3 months, because at the end of 3 months, you've got no client. And so you need to be doing both at the same time. It's a very fine balancing act to get there.
I always found in the early days, you know, when it was just me, when I was busiest with project work seemed to be when I was busiest with the kind of the sales and the, you know, invoicing Skypes and doing all that kind of stuff as well. There never seemed to be this kind of nice plateau of, oh, this week I'm mostly designing and then next week I've got a bunch of meetings lined up for the week after. And it's managing that. I think having someone in the office that is dedicated to that is a huge help. And someone that's much more efficient. You know, I'm much more efficient at designing than writing invoices and emails and setting up meetings and all that side of it. So yeah, it's definitely a case of doing what you do best. I think
on that, just quickly, I always think about like the type of thought processes, right? And to look after the pennies and the pounds and to do that properly. And I'd like, Tom, clearly your business got way bigger than mine ever did, because I was always like, I can make red. That's cool. Amazing. I don't need to make someone else's red. So, like, yeah, point taken. And yeah, really valuable one too. What I was going to say is about the about how efficient you can be as a designer and how inefficient that same brain can be as someone who needs to be an accountant and a CFO and all of these kind of things. I always think about, I've been accused of not being great at linear thought. And what I tend to defend myself with is, hey, you know what? I'm great at not linear thought. but you need someone who can do that other stuff, right? So if you've got a buddy who can help you out, if you're going to sell, like, I'm talking about the early days. Did you have someone that you could reach out to that was either in your friend group and or something else where you could go, I need some help with this. I just need you to, like, be kind of a nag at me or something like that. Because that's what I needed, right?
Someone to bounce off as well.
Yeah. Like a nice division of labor. I'll handle this stuff. Like, I'll sit at this end of the kitchen. You sit that end of the kitchen. You operate a laptop. I'll work a pen. Let's do that.
Not so much. I mean, my wife's actually a teacher, but she was writing kind of copy for websites and things like that, which I'm not great at. Her dad and her granddad both ran businesses as well, so you get advice off those. Mm-hmm. And you do know people in your friendship group that kind of have done these things, and you can talk to them about it, but it can be kind of quite lonely because no one's really done exactly what you're doing. And especially when you're working from home, everyone's now working from home and people seem to be loving it. But I suspect a year in, that's going to be wearing quite thin when you don't have the constant kind of, you can't just ask someone a question who would know the answer and get on with it. It's, you're kind of just by yourself and you have to research and find out and make stuff up and hope it's the right decision. It's kind of quite lonely doing that, really. It'd have been good to have someone to work with in those early days. But now Mike, who's here, is now our technical director. And so he takes a really big part in running the company. So you've got decisions about quotes and invoices and all these things, and you just need a second opinion. There's someone who knows kind of explicitly what the whole company is and can provide sound advice, and that just wasn't there in the first kind of 2 years.
So to advise anyone that's thinking about a similar thing, clubbing up with someone else would probably be a really good starting point if you gel with them. Maybe they're an ex-colleague or whatever. Would you recommend it, or would you say
they don't bail on day one?
Well,
Tom's probably got more experience than that, but if you don't put on, I suspect you can find pros and cons for the approaches, and you need to find some way of working, and it's going to be tough in either. It's not something to take lightly, and working with someone is not a decision to make lightly as well, because I mean, these companies got 30 years until we retire. I mean, that's a long time to be business partners with someone that you decide you can't actually work with.
So you're going to sacrifice that big sort of slice of decision making as well. Like, if you're the soloist, it's in your vision. If it's a partnership, then yeah, there's you gain an awful lot, of course, and like, we spoke to the guys at Coa about that, and that's really well for them. But I know that I'm not sure I would fit really well in that, in having to willfully sacrifice a large chunk of my own direction and control over the whole company and what the sort of look and feel of the agency would be.
Yeah, and what happens when you need to have those quite robust discussions, and if it all goes a bit wrong, you know, it's a bit awkward. That point on kind of the soloist comes on quite nicely to a question we had on from Cormac, we've got design partners that we had on, and he said, how much consideration goes into standing out from the competition when you're setting up? In terms of, for either of you guys, and for Drew as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think for us, or for me, early days starting out, what I thought the business would be and the kind of clients I thought we would have is very different to actually where we are now. And what I assumed that the kind of clients that I would get and what we're kind of pitching towards was my background in electronics. Every product I worked at, you know, up until that point had some form of electronics and sports. That's kind of the two things I know, and that's kind of what we were trying to pitch. But the first year, at one point, most of our clients were female beauty products. Yeah. You know, and you can't plan for that. But then from a kind of business pitching point of view, I think there's a lot of industrial design agencies, consultancies, and they're certainly the kind of places that I was having the interviews with. But what I wanted to create was a consultancy that actually, not maybe as far as you, Tom, in terms of mechanical engineering, we're kind of somewhere in between. I see us as the design for manufacture kind of partners, but we don't take on, or we have a mechanical engineer that we bring in when we need, and we have electronics engineers when we do, you know, when we need them. But our kind of USP, I guess, starting out was that we are the full process. And yes, we're an industrial designer at the start, but we've worked on mechanical electronics projects. And, you know, my kind of experience before Dyson was very mechanical, although I wasn't a trained mechanical engineer. My job going to consultancies, they were pretty much like, you're too mechanical. you're not an industrial designer. I'm like, I know, but I want to be. So that was my kind of thought process, I guess, is that, yeah, we're pitching something that we can take your product and we can get it all the way through every different process, you know, and we have the right people to do that. And that isn't always the people that we have in the office. We kind of a bit more, a friend coined it, a Hollywood agency in terms of, you know, you don't have all the actors on the payroll. you bring them in when you need them. So I've got a very good mechanical engineer. We've got a really good electronics engineer and a really good fashion designer. And we bring them in on different projects kind of when we need them. So, but yeah, I mean, where we've ended up and the kind of projects we've worked on and the kind of business that we are is not what I would have guessed or what I kind of planned it to be.
Did you assume that, I might be right or wrong in saying this, but did you assume that a lot of your work would be local as well?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because our kind of, maybe it was our first client that was purely organic, was local. He was actually a mile down the road. So yeah, I mean, that was almost 3 years ago. I had dinner with him a couple of months ago, and I told him he was our third client. He was like, what? Probably wouldn't have gone with you guys. luckily, he's a happy client. Yeah, the local thing is interesting. Most of our clients are London-based. I think that's inevitable.
International?
No. No, not yet. Mainly London, Birmingham. And then we have a small kind of local hub. It's quite interesting. We get people seem to find us through Google Maps. It's an interesting one.
Okay.
On the local side. So yeah, quite a mix. But I'd say, yeah, a lot of London. But I think for us being outside of London, I don't know, Tom, if you have the same kind of view, but I think being outside of London is a little bit of a novelty. Especially like for our clients. We had one at this weekend, actually. He booked a meeting Monday so he could come down for the weekend with his family, you know. That's that's happened a few times, is people actually like, no, I want to get out of London, you know. I live in London, I work in London. Actually, this is something that it's a passion project, it's something that I wanted to kind of take away. And so yeah, we haven't found that as necessarily a problem, but yeah.
No, I've never had a problem about stuff being in London, and you're on big consumer products, at least you inevitably end up working with a manufacturer in the Far East. So, I think working with people in Japan and China and India and Taiwan, and the fact that you're an hour outside London makes absolutely no odds. And I think in my entire career, I've spent 2 days working in London.
Okay.
I've spent 2 weeks working in Osaka and 3 months working in Gujarat. So London really isn't the centre of the world, although it can seem like that from some perspectives.
Definitely from like a designer perspective, I always find that, I'm pretty sure I've said this on LinkedIn a few times, there is life outside of London. You know, you don't have to work for Layer, therefore, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can go outside of London.
I mean, those places aren't actually that big. If you compare them to DCA, where I used to work, Cambridge Consultants, and the kind of whole Cambridge bubble, they're
tiny,
The big places are actually outside, and I don't know why it seems to be. Perhaps that's more of the styling, industrial design side of it.
But I think it's more of an ID hub, isn't it, London? Mm. But when you're looking at kind of design for manufacture, then I don't know if there are too many places in London that do PDD do, but there's not many, you know, that are actually end to end in London. I've always found it's very, very front end.
Yeah, you've got Crux and Kinnear Dufour in Bristol as well. Mm. So to be honest, I don't think I could name a consultancy that does the kind of technical product development that those companies and we're trying to do that's in London.
It's a strange one, because once you're in it and once you sort of interrogate it a little bit, there's good, I mean, good, really strong agencies like Small Fry in Coventry. And then, you know, we've mentioned Design Reality in a couple of times.
But there's also a great education that comes with it as well, though, in terms of if you was to go to a smaller agency or to go outside of London. I find to go to those places where you actually become a better designer than if you was just to go to the bigger ID agencies, for example. I find if you went to Small Fry, my genuine opinion is you'll actually become a better designer.
Go where the actual work is for you. Like if you're starting out and you're trying to find that work, then you can get some big names on your CV. But I think, I don't know. I didn't have that experience, but I do think that I'll just throw an unqualified thing. Go where you're going to do the work, where you can point to, I did that, I had that influence, I was responsible for this thing and this piece of work.
Mm.
Like geography is not a big, shouldn't be a big deal anymore.
Generally, the smaller the company you work for, probably the bigger the kind of the piece of the pie and your involvement. I mean, I went from very much a family business of about 6 of us to 3,000, and it's mad. That day one is like stepping into Willy Wonka's, and it's just kind of overwhelming to start off with. And then you kind of, when you get down onto a department level, you know, I'm in a team of 6, and you know, you're suddenly in that kind of small team environment again, but you're working on such a small piece of the pie. I absolutely love my time at Dyson and worked on some really interesting things, but you know, you are a very small cog in a big wheel. And you know, to give an example, like Dan, our youngest designer, you know, he's a few years out of uni, and he's taken full stage one concept briefs, you know, almost completely on his own, and delivered that to the client. And then he's working on, you know, design for manufacture as well. So I think that experience, you know, he might not have at a larger company. And I think that's what I like about consultancies as well, is that we are those kind of many hats, and that's kind of how my brain works. I like jumping around onto different things.
It's also nice when you get the chance to kind of have an influence on how the work will be done as well, rather than just like, rather than just the drawing and the things that are on the page and all of that. It's more about the, like, here's the ethos, here's the path we're going to take. And like, as I've got older and got more sort of zoomed out from the hands-on, I mean, I do less and less blue foam modeling these days, and I miss that, and I kind of make sure that I keep it in my schedule. But then again, you get a lot of satisfaction from going, well, like, here's the stance we want to take when it comes to the design, and making sure that, and like, Tom, this is probably something that I think from some of the things that you said, actually, you can pick whichever Tom. Yeah, it's nice when you sort of do get a little bit, you're a bit more removed from the hands-on. You're not quite at the coalface, but you're kind of, you're guiding the way. And I guess you must have both.
You change what you're designing. You're changing from designing a product to designing a business.
Yes.
And so you, it's still a design process. You still have to think creatively and laterally, and there's stuff that needs doing in a certain way and stuff that can be done in any way. And yeah, that's the kind of transition that the creative part of your mind is doing something completely different to where you started at. And you don't really learn that in any course. You just kind of have to do it.
Yeah. I think my time at Dyson, kind of, I tried to get into the business side as well. I always had an interest in the commercial side. So I was always kind of knocking on the door of the kind of sales and marketing guys and trying to get into meetings and have a bit of exposure to that to see how a bigger business kind of works. And I think Dyson's quite good at a lot of people having exposure to that kind of high up management decisions. You know, I was, you know, probably less than a year in, I was sat around a table with James, you know, reviewing the product I've been working on, which was an amazing experience. But at the same time, you know, those meetings, you could come out there with a completely different direction than you would have wanted to take it. And I think in a smaller consultancy, we know we can really drive the direction of the project and the product. I mean, with the client, obviously they're kind of say is final, but you know, we can put the options on the table and we can kind of say, you know, this is the way that we'd take it, and you'd hope that your kind of experience stands there. Whereas working for a company like that is very much, you know, there's top level decisions happening and being, you know, the worst thing is when your project's canned, which is a lot of the time at Dyson. So, I was very lucky. So
how does it work? Because Dyson, I used to work at JCB, and I suspect it's similar, that there's a big personality at the top and they own a lot of the company, and when they want something done, stuff gets done. So it's like a enormous family company in that respect.
So Tom, I was going to ask you that same question about you and about your setup, because, like, forgive me, you said your company was called, like, it has your name in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So back at you. Like, so, your name's on the door.
Yeah.
What, like, you know, let's explore the Dyson thing. Sure. But what are you trying to create? What kind of atmosphere are you conscious of? I find that fascinating because, well, yeah, it's a fine thing.
I mean, yeah, so I was a DCA for kind of 6 years, and that was great, and I loved it, and I'd always kind of just wanted to do my
such a big fan of DCA thing.
Yeah, they it's an amazing bunch of people. They do fantastic stuff, and just learn so much there. But I've always kind of wanted to do my own thing, and it was just the opportunity to do it, really. I guess DCA got larger when I was there. It maybe got 30% larger, which isn't really big compared to like TV where I was before, where it was the same similar size to Dyson. But I kind of wanted something a bit more personal where you could, where you'd actually know everyone and can be a bit more of a family feel. And then Yeah, you just have the flexibility of doing it your own way. And to be honest, I don't really know where that end goal is. You kind of roughly put it out there somewhere and you work towards it. But one of the beauties is that you can work with people and you can work out actually where is it going to go.
Can I just pick up on what Tom was just saying about wanting to strike out on his own?
Oh, sorry.
And create something for yourself.
Hmm.
I mean, yeah, that's brilliant. I think so many of us can identify with that. And what I'm interested in right now is, so you've made something for yourself, and now you have people working with you and for you and alongside you and all of that, and however you want to frame that, because I honestly don't know what your structure is like. But now people are working under your name.
Mm.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
I can remember when I got our first office, because this is our second office now, but we had a smaller one to start with. So I guess like Tom, I start in a spare room, you get an office, and then that runs out of space and you get a bigger office, which is then far too big. But yeah. I can remember just sitting there, and we shared the building with another company, and everyone was gone. I think it was a Friday afternoon or something. And I just looked around and it was kind of like, I have an office. How did I get here? And I just kind of just sat there laughing to myself. And like, what a bizarre thing. And if you tried to plan, yes, I am going to get this office at this particular point, it probably wouldn't. And you just need to evolve and flow with it. And it was just like bizarre that we'd started from, well, to be honest, when I started, it was like the dining room table, because I hadn't even cleared out the spare room to put in a desk. And you've got from there to all these different places and all these different things that we'd made happen. And none of them were massive at the time. Well, some of them were massive, but it wasn't just a sudden nothing, everything. It was all these little bits. And suddenly you've ended up with something that just didn't exist before.
Mm.
It was just surreal almost that happened.
Okay, so following on from that, what is on the roadmap that you haven't yet done? Question for both of you. What's left? Is it a book, a TV show? where we go with this?
Better not be a podcast.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's too many of those already.
For us, it's I think what we've kind of shied away from so far is having our own product, and I think that's an interesting kind of movement.
Building your own IP, kind of.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So, and I completely shied away from that in the first few weeks of the business because I wanted to do the consultancy model. Early on, we had our own product that we got a bit of funding for in the early days when I was kind of making up design time, I guess. But
I think that's valuable, though. I mean, we've talked about this before for graduates about just getting something into your portfolio. If you can't find a gig, then just make one.
Just build it yourself. Absolutely. Yeah. And we created a product that we've shown it's for the camera videographer industry, and still no one's launched one. And we get it out once in a while and we have videographers in, and they're like, why aren't you selling these? Why don't you? And it's like, well, it's not a business I want to run. I know it's a good product. I know it probably would sell, but I don't want to run that business. I don't want to be sending shipments out and getting returns and that side of it. It doesn't interest me. But recently, so early on as well, we got a lot of people saying, well, I'd love to do this product, but you're quite expensive. Can we do some kind of royalty agreement? And the answer's always been no.
I get that a lot. we'd love to work with you, but you're really expensive. And then you go, okay, nothing I can do really about that.
And the thing is, like 90% of the time, you've just met them. It's like, I'm not going into business with you. We just met. Recently, we have done that on our first project, which is the Kickstarter we've got running at the moment, Couple, the water bottle. That was the first one where we'd completed the design. We had we had the product complete. We pitched to help them through manufacture. So we said, look, we'll go to China, we'll find a manufacturer for you, and we'll help you build up that Kickstarter campaign. And they said, you know, that's great, but the budget doesn't really extend to that. Will you, you know, can we talk about some other means? And that's the first time we thought, actually, really believe in the product, love working with you guys. If we're ever going to do it, this is the time. Mm. So it took quite a while to sort out, you know, the whole legal side, which we didn't realize that's a whole nother story. But now we do kind of own a part of that. And that has, you know, made it really interesting for us, because we're now on that kind of other side. We are, you know, we're on that kind of client side in terms of the Kickstarter, and we're trying to push that as much as we can. But what I think, back to your original question, I definitely have that entrepreneur urge to own a product at some point, but it has to be the right one. It has to be the product that I want to sell, basically, and kind of carry on running that product. There's one thing, I think that's what I learned early on in my career, is there's one thing selling something, but that product's around a long time, and you've got to then want to run that business.
They don't disappear. It could be 10 years, and I looked at making products and stuff, and you're like, the thing I actually enjoy is designing the product. Yeah. So why would I start a business to make a product where every 3 years I get to design one, when I could just design stuff all the time? People that love running businesses, selling to customers and other businesses, can go and run that bit. And just what you enjoy. You know, I mean,
I'm so with you. Me and Jess were at, like, we were out earlier, and we saw that there's this huge Euro Millions jackpot this Friday, right? So we're like, okay.
Have you spent it already? Have you?
Yeah, exactly. What I'm going to do is buy a unit in the Deeside Industrial Park, right? And I'm going to set up a manufacturing opportunity for, like, so real opportunity for people in North Wales to manufacture sweet, high-end audio equipment. The kind of thing that would become an heirloom, right? So, like, you want your granddad's Kendrick audio unit, whatever it is, right? It's a record player. It's made out of wood and aluminium and all these and glass and beautiful materials, right?
Yeah.
So immediately, like, what'd you spend it on? You go, well, yeah, a Lamborghini and a... all this. I'm like, no, fuck that. Yeah. I want to spend it on a high-end audio company. Like, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to make it. I have to build a decent road to get to there. So that's fine. But I've got 110 million. So we're going to leverage other investment. It's it's the runaway creative mind of.
I actually always wanted a business making guitars, and I did try it.
Exactly. Right, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but like there's
so if you win the Euro Millions, can we start
the Osman Kendrick guitar, the OK guitar.
This is it. It's like if I win Euro Millions, I'm going to Scottsdale, Arizona. I'm going to visit the Fender plant. Right?
Yeah.
We're going to learn how they do it. I'm going to come back to North Wales. We're going to set it up. We're going to, like, okay, so we need all these types of CNC machines. We're going to make it out of these tone woods. But, oh my God, like, I make my own guitars already. They're shit because I'm bad at making guitars.
It's so good to have that side project, though.
Yeah, you've got to have something that you, like, that is
absolutely
associated to what you love. Like, so the design, like, I'm going to say I'm good at that. I get paid to do that, right? So I'm okay at it. Mm. But go the other way and just go, like, I don't care what sells. I don't care what is, you know, what meets the user requirements. This is the thing that just makes me excited about it, right?
Just before we came on this, I was in the garage.
You're always doing surfboards, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. So that's, so Hydrofoils is my thing at the moment, my weekend. nice. Evening job. Learning. Shaping surfboards, glassing surfboards. So I've made a surfboard. I'm on my third hydrofoil, and that's been such a learning curve. You know, that's I started probably too cocky. I can do this. It's easy, you know. So I 3D printed the cores, carbon fiber layout, looked awesome, absolutely awesome. Rode like an absolute hunk of, it's like building the world's worst guitar, you know, the equivalent. And it's taken me kind of 4 iterations, but that has taken me so far out of my comfort zone, because that's, you know, it's naval architecture, really. If we're getting down to it, what I really need is an aeronautical engineer to look at the shape, because I know I can make a carbon fiber thing. Whether it will function well as a hydrofoil, that's what's taking me, you know, the time to do it. But that's what I'm really interested in, because that's the learning curve. And I think that's, you know, we're all on this kind of learning journey. And and actually, yeah, it's that learning curve that's exciting with any of these things, you know, and actually to then go and use something that you've created for yourself, you know, there's no better feeling than that. And that comes back to us as close as you can get to a consultancy model. You know, if you're working on a product that you can see the whole way through that you're going to buy at the end, you know, hopefully get a freebie. That's the dream. That's really how I started out.
Yeah. And to anyone that's listening to this and not watching, you should see these three guys' faces light up when they were talking about the thing they do outside of work. So honestly, the guitars on a surfboard. Yeah. It's like you could just tell that is the passion. That's the reason why they got into the job in the first place, basically.
Absolutely. There's got to be a thing that you encountered as a teenager where you go, shit, someone had to draw that. Someone had to figure out, like, why is that shape? And Osman, so like with guitars, it was the same for me. I decided cars, I like them, they're cool, but basically if I was going to do that as a career, I ended up drawing steering wheels or gear knobs. And that's boring as batshit. Like if I could, honestly, if I could draw a lamp or a guitar and have it made, that would be incredible.
But the funny thing is, though, working at a place like Dyson, going to Dyson, right, vacuum cleaners, God, how boring could that be? You know, that was my thought going into it is, what am I doing, you know? But then actually what I found interesting was in the intricacies and what you are designing, and that thing could have been going into anyway. It could have been going into an Aston Martin or, you know, it's so removed from the actual final product. That's where I found that enjoyment, you know, and day one working on robots and things like that, that's exciting. But I think that's where, you know, for people thinking about getting a job is, you know, just because the top level name or kind of what they do seems boring, it's actually what you do within that can be really interesting. And you kind of find your kind of area within that.
I suppose it's the stuff you don't see. I mean, all three of us are kind of now talking about manufacturing stuff, and it's not really seen as the sexy bit of design. Like, what did I design? It's that thing. It's on the shelf. You can see it. You can buy it. But we design bits of mold tooling and and nests and things that people use as a job and little robots.
Yeah.
This might get seen by 20 people a day.
But if you've seen it, you're proud of it.
It's a product in the same way that everything else is. It's just not shouted about.
Absolutely.
It has to be usable. It has to be robust. It has to work and work and work. In many respects, it has to do that better than the actual product, because you're using it 2 million times a year. And that's to be overlooked by quite a lot of people, that the thing you're making is not the whole problem. The whole problem is everything from start to finish.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, most people are not going to notice that.
No.
And they're not going to notice it. Like, if it's a really well-designed product, you're not going to notice it, because it isn't going to piss you off.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You made something that didn't piss someone off today.
Yes.
Well, I just wanted
if
to.
If you're a mate of mine and you're in John Lewis, you're going to know about it.
Yeah.
It up. That's my bit.
Do you see your work? Okay. Do you see your work in the next 10 years? Do you see what you're doing now? Do you see there being that changing in 10 years' time? You think about what's happening in the world right now and just how super crazy it is.
I think yes and no. Yes, the overall world is changing, and people doing product design at university should definitely be learning UI, UX, looking at some kind of digital side, which we didn't do. You know, that's, you know, definitely learning our Arduinos, you know, pick up electronics and have more of that digital experience. And I think the future of the kind of the workplace and jobs, and that would be vital. For me personally, I think there will always be, you know, a place for what we're doing today. I think physical products that don't have any electronics, you know, will always exist and become, you know, even more important, I think. especially in terms of sustainability. And I, you know, I talk about this quite a lot in terms of product designers being pivotal in that, because we see products so early on in the design process, we get to make those kind of decisions, and our effect can be huge. So designing for the future isn't far off what we're doing now.
What are you doing now? Yeah.
I think so. It's maybe not the answer you're expecting, but. No.
Is it a good future? Is it a bright future? Because every time I turn the news on, it's a bit doom and gloom. So if you guys are designing the future, what is it going to be a nice future?
I think so. I think it looks pretty cool.
Brad, the future is always nice, and the news about the future is always bad.
Oh, nice.
It always has been. It's always been, hey, everything's changing and we're not ready for it. Mm. It's like, well, no one's ready for change. That's why we're having change. Yeah. But the fact is, if you just said, like, okay, so I'm going to look around my room. I've got this massive Marshall amp, like the other side of the room. That hardware won't change for 20 years. I'm going to keep that for 20 years. But the software that drives it, that's going to change in a few months. I'm going to download something new for it. And that's, to me, indicative of the next at least a few years of product design, is that we're going to have good hardware that is designed to be robust. But like the way that it operates, that will be changeable.
Mm. Because I think the overall,
you've got a solid phone that's got a great camera, and this is why we have all these software updates on our phones, because we get bored. And there's something new, and there's something
keeps
better.
Them busy, doesn't it? Keeps them.
But also, yeah, I mean, like a lot of that, given by cadence of release, right? But if you just went no, like a few years ago, there was a limitation on how often Premier League clubs could update their home kit. I think that seemed to stick around for 2 years and then go away again. But that made sense. Like, that's the home kit. That doesn't need to change. Like, it's red or it's blue or it's stripy or whatever.
Yeah.
But the numbers on the back, they change. Mm. It's the same with, like, another example, my record player is the same record player that was made in 1982, same year as me. But the records that are played on it are totally different from then.
But I think what's really refreshing, what we've seen from our clients' point of view, is the constant idea that we haven't designed everything. You know, just because these things exist, there's a better way. And I think that's really interesting. And talking to my parents, you know, I tell them what we're designing, like, how could you make a better one? Like, mine works. It's like, well, it works, but trust me, there's something that's going to be even better, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to make your life easier. And I think looking into kind of history of design, it goes through kind of peaks and troughs. I think, you know, reading up on like the kind of 60s, 70s, there's a real feeling that there's something else. There's something bigger. There's going to be change, and there's this big kind of world ahead of us. And I think in the last kind of decade, 15 years, there's this kind of feeling of, you know, what else is there? Mm. It's like, are we kind of reiterating and things like that? Yeah. But then starting the business, I think I was slightly nervous about that before I started the business. Like, is that true? And it's really not, you know, talking to our clients that are actually you know, they're coming up, they're coming to us with these ideas, things that, you know, like, God, why has no one done that? You know, we need to get this out. And I think that's really refreshing, and that will continue. And I think that will keep driving us forward, and that keeps me motivated.
Good stuff. What about you, Tom?
I mean, coming back to something Drew said on the software updating, I mean, that's fine until stuff kind of gets rigged. So the servers stop. And like, I had an iPod, and it had, I was a big, I collected a lot of music, and there was a lot of music on that. I didn't need it on a phone or anything like that. I just had an iPod. It worked and it was fine. I could buy more music and it was just there. And then all of a sudden Apple said it wasn't secure enough to buy any music anymore. So it's kind of like this thing that I've had for, God knows how long I've had it, 8 years, that had been absolutely fine, been around the world, battery still worked, I think sound was still good, it was still perfect.
Yeah.
Just, I was just told it didn't work anymore, and that's it.
Still but found a way to put that EU through album.
You buy a new thing. Yeah. No, it's horrible. That's why so many people go, do you know what? I'll just Samsung it then. You absolute arsehole. And then, you know, I'm like, look, I've just got myself a new 11.
Whatever it is. Oh,
yeah. I'm like, oh my God, it looks so nice when you tap it. And like, it, just the buttons work so beautifully. It's amazing. Yeah, I know you're going to fuck me over in like 18 months, but honestly, I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
I'm okay with it. I've got an iPod Nano and there's nothing physically wrong with it, but it won't start up. Like, yeah, I'm cross about that, but I forgive you. It's okay. Because your font choices are so nice. I sound like an arsehole. Even just describing, like, endorsing that kind of a thing.
Can you imagine that? Yeah, that would never... That product is for such a limited point of time. You'll never get someone going, oh, I've got this iPod Nano that was made the year I was born. And you're like, that is never going to be a thing. So stuff...
Can you rob it and someone in a riot? Because that's all it's good for. So this is like, I've got a Pioneer turntable right here. It's from the year I was born, and it's perfect. Like, you can change out components because... someone still makes them. But could you imagine if Ford went, we're not going to make this Focus anymore, and I don't know, Vauxhall went, okay, well, we will. Because like, like, Daewoo used to do that, right? Daewoo used to go, well, we've got expired, we're just going to make cars that are expired IP from other manufacturers. They're fine. They are cars. They work, right? You can drive them.
You can still buy a Fiesta that's made by Mazda.
Exactly, yeah.
So sustainability and all that stuff, I suspect that materials science is going to have a much bigger role in future products. Because we can't go on. And it needs to be joined up thinking as well, because we've got all this materials that's used. I've been looking at like biodegradable plastics. So people talk about bioplastics, still a plastic. It's still going to last 10,000 years in the environment. It's still going to make all the microplastics end up in the bottom of the sea in the food chain and get back into us and all these things. Just because it's made from corn oil instead of crude oil doesn't make a difference. And you look at it and the energy to make the bioplastic is significantly more than the energy to make the plastic from crude oil. And where does that energy come from? And if they're burning crude oil to make a bioplastic for marketing purposes, the net effect is actually worse by doing that. You may as well buy the cheap out of the ground crude oil and process that.
I'm pretty sure I read something about electric vehicles, which was quite similar in terms of the production of it, in terms of it's something to do with the batteries, and when the battery kind of runs out, it's far more damaging because you can't really do anything with it. I haven't got something to hand, but I definitely read something about how electric vehicles is far more damaging than what you would think in terms of the production of
lithium. Lithium's a nasty thing, really. Yeah. And the heavy metals and all these kind of things, but equally petrol's quite a crazy thing to let members of the pit squirt around. I think there's a lot of, it's a very narrow marketing view on this is good, and everything else is bad. You have to look at what's going into it and what's going to come out of it, and that's not done. There's a whole load of, well, I don't know if it's education there, but people need to start thinking about the entire life.
Yeah, this full product life cycle.
Rather than just seeing David Attenborough saying, look, guys, we're running out of koalas, you know. Just go a little bit deeper and actually fully educating people on it's more than just animals.
Like, definitely don't believe the marketing. Never, ever believe that. Like, as a product designer, we can all agree on never, ever, ever believe marketing.
and as a salesperson, I can definitely vouch for that. We always have kind of twos and pros of marketing. I do think you're right though on sustainability. I'm really surprised. I'm yet to see a product design agency that's really branded themselves in that way. And I think that could be something that could happen where they'll actually their whole branding and their business model would reflect that. Do you agree, or do you?
I think if you sort of pin your reputation to sustainability, like, it's so easy to like slaughter that reputation because it's too big.
Yeah,
yeah,
and like, it's too new a science, so we don't know much about it.
I think people buy products because they are good at doing what they do. If it's sustainable, even better. And that even better will become essential. We'll all be sustainable product design consultancies because we have to be. Mm. And I think, listening to a lot of podcasts and like the guys at Method and those kind of places where, you know, sustainability is the core of the business, but it's second to the industrial design of the bottle, because that at the end of the day is what people are buying, you know, that's why they're going to the shops, and they are, you know, as sustainable as they can be in the other areas. But that is once they've got a very good product. And what we are trying to do is just educate our clients as much as we can, as early as we can, with design decisions. And we had a Kickstarter kind of really early on where we worked with these guys, and it was a plant pot effectively, but it was based, you know, they found this NASA white paper about using plants as indoor air purifiers and how to make them as efficient as possible at doing that. And we designed this plant pot, which worked fantastically well, I thought, you know, looked fantastic. And we said to them, look, this is the product, but it has to be sustainable. It was mid David Attenborough series, you know, plastics are the absolute enemy. And we said, you know, we need to be looking at other ways to make this. And they said, no, it's got to be virgin plastic because we want these colors. And they ran with it, and it went on to Kickstarter. And the first comment was, you know, something like, hang on, this is a lot of virgin plastic. And you know, they didn't get funded. And that's just an example of where I think, you know, really early on, they had that decision-making process of, you know, a plant pot is only going to last a few years. We could make it degradable. You know, we could make this thing so it only lasts a few years and, you know, hit that price point and all the rest of it and not damage the environment. But then it kind of bit them on the ass towards the end. So, yeah, can be done well and not so well.
Yeah, good stuff. Well, I really enjoyed that. I don't know about you guys. First time recording for a while for you, Drew. Does it feel good to be back in the hot seat? Or?
really good to be back, actually. I really enjoyed talking to both of you, even you, Brad.
Thank you for coming on, taking the time in an evening as well. I do really appreciate that. I think it's evident that I mean, the whole purpose of why we did this, Drew, was to keep everyone connected in these really weird times. So the fact that you guys are willing to take, you know, you're still in the studio, Tom, so, you know, we really do kind of appreciate that effort. Next Monday, we've got our webinar. I don't actually think I'll have edited this in time, so I'll put it on the outro anyway. But on Monday, we've got our second webinar. So we've got the guys over at Noli coming on. I haven't got that product to hand. They did give me some stuff. I can't even do the product. I can't even do the product placement on this one because it's over there somewhere. It's charging. So yeah, excuse the.
You got your Dyson Air.
Yeah.
Is it like an air cooler?
Is that you, Tom? Was you part of this brain?
Not responsible for that in any way.
Good stuff. Because the reason why is because it's actually quite shit at cooling. It's very good at heating, but the cooling function of it isn't that great. So don't waste your time if you're thinking about buying this thing.
People are surprised that it doesn't churn out cold air. It's like...
Yeah, it's not. it's a lot better as a heater than it is as a cooler.
The massive, massive fans from Screwfix.
Yeah.
Do we buy £5,000 air conditioning or do we just buy massive fans?
Oh, man. Our first office had a glass roof. Can't do that in 30 degrees.
I just open the kitchen window and the living room window fully, and then I get a crick in my neck from sitting in a draft.
Yeah, well, you can all laugh now, but I'll tell you who's going to be laughing in December. It's going to be me and my pure cool. So, cheers, guys. So we've got they're coming on. Jordan Burns coming on. He's going to chat to us about how not to freelance as well. So there's a bit of a bolt on for what we chatted on here. And then our next guest is going to be Merle over at Canada 4. She's coming on. So that's going to be really cool to chat to her. No idea what we're going to talk about, but we don't really know what we're going to talk about in most cases. We just kind of wing it and it's got us this far. So cheers, guys. Thanks for coming on.
So thanks for both Toms for coming on the pod. An experience having two guests on with the same name, but I think we pulled through. I think we pulled through okay. If you want to know more about what we're doing, then I guess just head over to www.designtruth.co.uk.